And then I think, Bryce, could we go to the next one? Okay. There's a picture of armor. You're thinking, what does the armor have to do with our sermon here? I was getting pictures from a couple different global conflicts. One, the conflicts between Palestine and Israel, and then also Ireland, the south of Ireland, and the north of Ireland, and England. We know about the Troubles. And raise your hand if you know about the Troubles in Ireland. It was a big news topic in the 20th century. It's kind of faded from relevance. But in looking at this psalm, and I decided not to put the pictures up because I thought, you know, we actually have veterans in the congregation, and I don't know if they want to see the, you know, battle scenes and the war and all the other explosions and different things like that. So I thought I nixed the photos, but I think I'm going to inform just a little bit about the different conflicts. Ireland, for about 800 or more years, has dealt with British, English rule. And it's not been pretty, more or less, the entire time. And so, especially within the south of Ireland, where they're Roman Catholic, and not like in the north of Ireland, where they're Protestant, and England became Protestant with Henry VIII. So there's kind of there's an ethnic battle between the two nations, the Irish and the English. There's a deal having to do with occupation and the Irish feeling like, hey, this is our land and why are you kind of ruling over us? There's a religious component. And then there's some differences of views of like politics and how they view what the role of a government is. And so between the Irish and the British, there's been a lot of violence over the last 1,000 years. And even like car bombs and little revolts and wars. If you look down through the history of the way England has treated Ireland, you'll find a lot of human rights atrocities. And so when a news story comes out, and we might not think much of it, but what we'd say like an act of terror, where there's a civilian population that receives some violence from kind of maybe a militia group or something, to us it might seem very weird and strange that people would treat each other that way. But for the Irish and the British, it actually goes back generations and hundreds and even, you know, 1,000 years, the animosity between the two groups. In the case of, Israel and Palestine, I'll actually get to that in a moment. I'll first start talking about the psalm here. It says, we talked last week about Zion, the importance of Zion, the city, Jerusalem, and how the nation of Israel would have looked at Zion as their home and Jerusalem and the proof that God was with them. This was their mighty great city. And they had the temple within it, all covered in gold and the sun shining on it. You can't hardly look at it. We looked at some of those quotes just about how beautiful the temple would have been. So you're thinking, okay, here's this temple and here's in the city, Jerusalem, this great city. It's not really a great nation, but they have this great city, and they're very proud of it. Well, Babylon comes, and they destroy the city, and they destroy the temple. And so it says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. So here the Judeans are in Babylon, and they're remembering Jerusalem and how great it is, and they're crying. There we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees. For our captors, they're asked, and, you know, the idea of hanging up your guitar, right? I'm not going to play it anymore because I don't have anything to be happy about anymore. It says, for our captors, they're asked us for songs, and our tormentors for rejoicing. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. So here they're being taunted. They're saying, hey, they've been enslaved, captured, enslaved. Their nation has been destroyed and burned down. Their temple has been desecrated. And the Babylonians are taunting them, say, hey, we want you to make music, you know. And you can think of situations in which there's human rights atrocities and disgusting levels of violence, the people will be on behaving so terribly that they will like mock the people that they're torturing, and that's kind of the picture here. So, I mean, we are reading it in kind of our Bible-ese language, you know, and this sounds like the Bible, right? It's Bible words. So we're not really feeling the emotion of what the author is saying. This is genuine. There'd be genuine hatred here because, you know, they were in their country. They were, I wouldn't say necessarily minding their own business, but they've got their own country. And then here's this foreign power comes in and murders a bunch of people, in some cases starves them to the point where people are willing to, like, eat other humans. So they slaughter a bunch of humans. And so you're thinking, okay, my cousin or my brother or my father or my wife or my child or my husband has been murdered by these people. And then they desecrated everything I care about, my religious system, the thing that I look to that proves that God is real, you know, that we have this city, Zion, and we have this temple. They've desecrated it and destroyed it. The thing that, you know, is the closest, most important thing to my heart is my, you know, relationship with God. And it's been the symbol of its reality has been destroyed. And then you're taken, ripped out of your home and taken to this other country. And the theory that these countries had is they wanted to erase, when they would do this, when they would take a country and take them out of their land, they wanted to erase all cultural identity. Okay? They wanted to erase people, their religious rights. They wanted to erase their language. They wanted to erase their ethnic identity, their culture, their celebrations. So here they're on top of that, they're getting tormented and mocked and belittled. And so there's real, genuine hatred there. How can we sing the Lord's song on foreign soil? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem as my greatest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it, down to its foundation. So the Edomites are people group that's watching Israel and Judah get, destroyed. And they're also piling on the mocking. Daughter Babylon, doomed in destruction. Happy is the one who pays you back what you have done to us. Happy is he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks. So with these the imprecatory psalms, and what these are is these are psalms in which the psalmist, a songwriter, is calling down condemnation and judgment against their enemies. And in these are some of the most difficult verses in the Bible. And this would have been a psalm that, for me, 20 years ago, I would have really wished wasn't in the Bible. Because I would say, oh, it doesn't fit with my understanding of the gospel and Jesus Christ. So I just wish it wasn't there. And so then when I come across it, I say, okay, well, what does it mean? So I go and I look up as many answers as I can that maybe excuse it away and say, oh, well, make an excuse for why it's in the Bible and try to kind of like defend it. And does anyone get where I'm coming from with this? in my younger years, I did a lot of evangelism. And so I would talk to people that had rejected Christianity or maybe grown up in a Christian home, maybe a little familiar with these verses. And they say, well, what about this? And I say, ooh, I don't know. I don't know how to, you know, that's kind of embarrassing that that's in my holy book. That's really, I don't, and I wouldn't really know how to defend it. What I've come to realize is that it's absolutely necessary to have this type of thing in Scripture. Thinking about this sermon, obviously we're dealing with the Jewish people and their hatred of another nation, and I thought of Palestine and Israel right now. After his name was Bar Kokhba. He lived about 2,000 years ago. So in 70 AD, Herod's temple was destroyed. We're here in Psalm 137. That's Solomon's temple that's destroyed. And then you're going to fast forward another 500 years, and Herod the temple's been rebuilt, and Herod does extra building on the temple and makes it into this magnificent world wonder that people come from countries all around the world to see this temple. It's a beautiful thing, and we looked at some pictures of it last week. And so Herod has this beautiful temple, and in 70 AD, Titus destroys the temple and sacks Jerusalem. Okay, this would be 40 years after the death of Jesus. And then you fast forward a few more generations into the second century. You have this guy, he's kind of a messianic type guy. We'd call him an antichrist. That's what us Christians would call him. His name is Bar Kokhba, son of the star. And he decided he really wanted to lead a rebellion of the Jewish people against Rome. And this, by the way, this is the reason Jesus got crucified, is because they were worried, right, that Jesus would lead kind of this rebellion against Rome, the temple would get destroyed and all the rest. Well, these things start to actually manifest. And so this guy, Bar Kokhba, he leads this, rebellion against Rome, and the rebellion is squashed. He is, executed. And Rome takes the Israelite people, the Judean people, out of their land and says, no more. You're just not allowed to be there anymore. And then they rename the land Palestine. This is a bit of world history. This happened about 2,000 years ago. Well, you fast forward about 1,800 years, and you get to... Have we got any book literature fans? People that like stories, novels? If you like Russian literature, I like Tolstoy. There's a good one. I like Fyodor Dostoevsky. And there's this book called Brothers Karamazov, writing about Russia. And within the story, when he talks about, so some of these Jewish people they went to, Romania and Germany and Russia and England and all over the world, because they got kicked out of what Rome, they titled Palestine. So they're all over the world. And in the Brothers Karamazov, Fyodor Dostoevsky talks about the Jewish people, and he talks about them like monsters. And they're very racist tropes that he has in his book. And some of you might be familiar with the theologian Martin Luther, the kind of big founder of Protestantism, right? And he led the Reformation. He was notoriously very anti-Semitic. He really hated Jewish people. Basically, what ended up happening is around the world and in Europe, in Russia especially, there were these things called pogroms, in which the Russians would not really, and sometimes a state would be involved, but sometimes it would just be villagers, just you know, peasants and serfs go to a Jewish area and kill all the Jewish people or burn down their homes, take their land. And there was a lot of religious persecution towards Jewish people. And it happened all over Europe. And so people started moving back to the land of Palestine. Jewish people started moving back and settling there. And I was raised in a denomination called the Plymouth Brethren. So, I don't know if I've talked about it before. They had this theologian named John Nelson Darby, and he's this he's kind of infamous. He's kind of a naughty word in theology. He created this thing called dispensationalism. And a lot of us were raised in a world where it's very common. So if you watch, say, the Left Behind movies, possibly, anyone? Yeah. Left Behind movies or read the books or whatever. John Nelson Darby eventually had a big input on even American culture. But back in the 1820s, he really began to develop this theology talking about Israel's return to Palestine and end times theology. And it became extremely popular. And Jewish people, and look, they were leaving religious persecution, extreme religious persecution. And so they would move back to the land of Palestine. And it eventually got so bad that the Nazi, Nazi Germany undertook a Holocaust, a genocide of Jewish people in Europe. And it was so bad for the Jewish people that basically a number of nations said, well, we need to create a homeland for the Jewish people to go back to. And so they kind of, in 1948, they create modern day Israel. And it just has not been smooth the entire time. Basically, it's been, and I think there's one thing we say hurt people. Have you ever heard that? Hurt people. And this idea of when you have something bad happen to you, you're more likely to act in a similar way towards somebody else. And that's kind of been kind of the story in Israel and Palestine. And that you think, the people that settled Israel were fleeing religious persecution and some violence, and then they kind of partook in some violence towards the people that were there in Palestine, and vice versa. And there's been, Palestinians would do, like, say, a suicide bombing of an Israeli, you know, area, and then maybe the Israeli government would go and kill some Palestinians, and there's been violence among settlers, you know, Israeli just citizens that would do violence to Palestinian people living in Palestinian areas there. It's a very complicated, very messy situation. And whatever our theology is, I think we can say we want the violence to stop, right? We want the violence to stop. We don't want that happening there. And it's very ugly. I think the estimates are since 2023, the Israeli government and the Palestinian government have said that there were 72,000 Palestinians killed. And I think like 25% of them were children. And I think I look at that situation there, and I think it's a really good picture for what we have here in Psalms 137, where you have generations of people going back, hundreds of years of violence and animosity and hatred towards one another. And I'm not in those people's shoes over there. I have friends that are from Palestine, and I've been to Israel and saw kind of what it was like during a brief period of peace there. And I can't get into those people's heads, but I do know that this feeling of happy is he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks, verse 9 there in Psalm 137, is a real genuine feeling that the people in that part of the world feel towards others. They really do feel that way. And as I look at the Psalms, what I have to say is, it used to be when I was younger, I remember even people saying this about Psalms. They would say, well, the psalmist, he didn't know what they were writing. They didn't even know, they didn't understand the theology, so they just wrote that and they didn't really get it. But now I look at this and I say, my holy book, the God that I worship, had stuff written down that reflects the world in which I live. And I'm comforted by that. Because as beastly as the world can be, the God of the Bible depicts it as it is. And it shows the world for what it is. And that gives me a sense of, I mean, it really, I have faith in God, understanding that God is a real God for the real world. And it's not make-believe or fake or talking about some fantasy land. And what did we say? All gumdrops and rainbows? It's not all gumdrops and rainbows? Is that, was it lollipops and gumdrops? Is that what it is? Okay. I don't know. It's not all gumdrops and rainbows. That's what I remember a classmate saying that in college, and I got a kick out of it. It's not all hunky-dory and shiny and nice. And sometimes the world and what we encounter, especially in cases of extreme violence, these emotions and feelings are genuine and real. And the psalmist depicts it and bares their heart and says, I really want violence to come back against those people. I looked up a couple other imprecatory psalms, and so I wanted to read this from Psalm 59, 10 through 15. It says, my God of mercy shall come to meet me. God shall let me see my desire on my enemies. The idea there is, the psalmist in Psalm 59 is saying, God is going to help me. He's going to help me see. Yeah, I'm going to be satisfied to see the bad thing that happens to my enemies. It says, do not slay them, lest my people forget. So allow my enemy to live. He says, scatter them by your power and bring them down. He says, okay. So he said, don't kill them, but now he's saying, bring them down. O Lord, our shield, for the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips. Let them even be taken in their pride and for the cursing and lying which they speak. He says, consume them in wrath. Okay, so he said, don't kill them. But then he said, bring them down. He says, consume them in wrath. Consume them that they may not be. So, right? Get rid of them. Take the enemies all the way. So first he says, don't kill them. But then he says, bring them down. He says, consume them. Now he says, make it so they don't exist. Then he says, let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. Well, now he's saying, okay, but okay, that let them know that God is in charge. So is it don't kill them, or is it kill them, or is it show them, give them a lesson? Because that's what he's saying. Let them know that God rules in Jacob. Give them a lesson. What is it? Is it kill them? Don't kill them. Give them a lesson. And at the evening they return. Okay, so now they've got agency. They growl like a dog and go all around the city. They wander up and down for food and howl if they are not satisfied. So what is, you know, is this all contradictory? No, I think what's happening is, and within these psalms, these imprecatory psalms, is there is such a outpouring of emotion that the person that is praying this prayer to God is just is giving all of their feelings of hatred and animosity to God. God, if you kill them, kill them. If you don't, teach them a lesson. But if you could, just kill them and make them go away. But if they're going to stick around, really make them see that they're – and right? And he's praying this prayer, and he's kind of all over the board, but the anger – is there, and that's what's depicted. Could you go to the next slide? In Psalm 58, another one, he says, "The godly will rejoice when they see injustice avenged. They will wash their feet in the blood of the wicked. Then at last, everyone will say, 'There truly is a reward for those who live for God. Surely there is a God who judges justly here on earth.'" And so this is the important aspect of these prayers. Is our anger, what our anger is anger is a good emotion. It is a good part of us that God gives us. And it's a compass. And what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to point us towards justice. Our anger, scripture tells us, be angry and sin not. You take your anger and you point it towards what's wrong in the world, and then you try to fix it. And so what we, I think, miss about a God of justice. When I was younger, when I would talk to people about Jesus, I had to spend all this time trying to defend God, you know. I shouldn't have been, but that's what I thought. I thought, I need to, you know, make excuses for why God allows, you know, or why God in the Bible talks about hell. And punishment and justice. And I thought, oh, I need to defend that and make these excuses for God so that people know that God is, you know, loving and kind and good. What I came to realize is that actually God's judgment and justice is a beautiful thing because it allows us to do something with our anger, and it tells us that God is in fact a God of love, right? A love necessitates anger at a point, because or hatred, I should say, because we ought to hate the things that harm the ones we love. Do you understand? So you say, let's say there's a relative, and a relative has an addiction, and the addiction is damaging the relative, and you love the relative. And you would give your own life for the relative. And what you begin after working with the relative, the struggling with addiction for years and years, is you begin to develop a hatred towards that thing that your relative is addicted to. This I'm sure all of us probably can think of people in our lives in which this is a reality. So the hatred is necessary there. And you might even think, man, I wish that the enabler for the addiction would get punished. The person that is creating the circumstances for the addiction. I think a recent example would be Purdue Pharma. If you remember, they went into communities like this, rural communities, especially down in Appalachia and Kentucky and West Virginia and Tennessee, and they basically systematically got entire populations addicted to opioids. They did it all on purpose, for money. And they've had court cases and they've lost them all in regard to this. And so somebody who's got family members or somebody even in the addiction might have genuine hatred towards Purdue Pharma. And man, I want them to get judged. And what scripture tells us about God is that God does judge, and God will he'll set the books right. And get justice for all. And that's what this says. It says, they will wash their, the godly will rejoice when they see justice avenged, right? When you say, man, I'm so glad that Purdue Pharma got their comeuppance. And another story, DuPont, their the poison in the water in West Virginia. There's a famous, there's a Teflon scandal. If you might have heard this one. Wolverine right in our backyard here with the PFAS, right? And we really want them to get their comeuppance. Then at last, everyone will say, there truly is a reward for those who live for God. Surely there is a God who judges justly here on earth. And I think we can all say, well, if there's no justice, there's no, I don't want to believe in a God that lets the wickedness off the hook. That's a big deal to me. And knowing that God is going to deal with those who have harmed us, I really want that. I really want to know that God is going to judge sin. And so these imprecatory psalms, and just for a point of application, they're something that we can lean into, where each of us can look at the things in society that that are, now in some cases it's hard for us to identify, right? Because we're kind of the, you know, we're the Roman Empire of the world, right? We're kind of on top of things. But in the ways in which we can identify and that we can say, hey, look, I do, there's this area or that area in which I really dislike and I'm angry about this injustice. We could pour that out to God and God can handle and hear our prayers. And also, I think we can do it on behalf of others in areas in which we see in the world in which there's injustice happening to others. We can say, and pour out our prayers to God and give God our anger. Now this is different. Remember we did the lament. We talked about lament a few weeks ago. This is different because this is really calling down the fire and brimstone out of heaven type of prayer, right? And I think that that's a pattern of prayer that we can participate in. Can you go to the next passage? The New Testament takes this idea and it helps us deal with these feelings. It says in Romans chapter 12, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. And then I think, Bryce, could we go to the next one? Okay. There's a picture of armor. You're thinking, what does the armor have to do with our sermon here? I was getting pictures from a couple different global conflicts. One, the conflicts between Palestine and Israel, and then also Ireland, the south of Ireland, and the north of Ireland, and England. We know maybe possibly about the Troubles. And raise your hand if you know about the Troubles in Ireland. It was a big news topic in the 20th century. It's kind of faded from relevance. But in looking at this psalm, and I decided not to put the pictures up because I thought, you know, we actually have veterans in the congregation, and I don't know if they want to see the, you know, battle scenes and the war and all the other explosions and different things like that. So I thought, I nixed the photos, but I think I'm going to inform just a little bit about the different conflicts. Ireland, for about 800 or more years, has dealt with British English rule. And it's not been pretty, more or less, the entire time. And so, especially within the south of Ireland, where they're Roman Catholic, and not like in the north of Ireland, where they're Protestant, England became Protestant with Henry VIII. So there's kind of there's an ethnic battle between the two nations, the Irish and the English. There's a deal having to do with occupation and the Irish feeling like, hey, this is our land and why are you kind of ruling over us? There's a religious component And then there's some differences of views of like politics and how they view what the role of a government is. And so between the Irish and the British, there's been a lot of violence over the last 1,000 years. And even like car bombs and little revolts and wars. If you look down through the history of the way England has treated Ireland, you'll find a lot of human rights atrocities. And so when a news story comes out, and we might not think much of it, but what we'd say like an act of terror, where there's a civilian population that receives some violence from kind of maybe a militia group or something. To us, it might seem very weird and strange that people would treat each other that way. But for the Irish and the British, it actually goes back generations and hundreds and even, you know, 1,000 years, the animosity between the two groups. In the case of, Israel and Palestine, I'll actually get to that in a moment. I'll first start talking about the psalm here. It says, we talked last week about Zion, the importance of Zion, the city, Jerusalem, and how the nation of Israel would have looked at Zion as their home. And Jerusalem, and the proof that God was with them. This was their mighty, great city. And they had the temple within it, all covered in gold, and the sun shining on it. You can't hardly look at it. We looked at some of those quotes just about how beautiful the temple would have been. So you're thinking, okay, here's this temple, and here's in the city, Jerusalem, this great city. It's not really a great nation, but they have this great city, and they're very proud of it. Well, Babylon comes, and they destroy the city, and they destroy the temple. And so it says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. So here the Judeans are in Babylon, and they're remembering Jerusalem and how great it is, and they're crying. There we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees. For our captors there asked, and you know, the idea of hanging up your guitar, right? I'm not going to play it anymore because I don't have anything to be happy about anymore. It says, for our captors were there asked us for songs, and our tormentors for rejoicing. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. So here they're being taunted. They're saying, hey, they've been enslaved, captured, enslaved. Their nation has been destroyed and burned down. Their temple has been desecrated. And the Babylonians are taunting them, say, hey, we want you to make music, you know. And you can think of the situations in which there's human rights atrocities and disgusting levels of violence. The people will be on behaving so terribly that they will like mock the people that they're torturing, and that's kind of the picture here. So, we are reading it in kind of our Bible-ese language, you know, and this sounds like the Bible, right? It's Bible words, so we're not really feeling the emotion of what the author is saying. This is genuine. There'd be genuine hatred here because, you know, they were in their country. They were, I wouldn't say necessarily minding their own business, but they've got their own country. And then here's this foreign power comes in and murders a bunch of people, in some cases starves them to the point where people are willing to, like, eat other humans. So they slaughter a bunch of humans. And so you're thinking, okay, my cousin or my brother or my father or my wife or my child or my husband has been murdered by these people. And then they desecrated everything I care about, my religious system, the thing that I look to that proves that God is real, you know, that we have this city, Zion, and we have this temple, they've desecrated it and destroyed it. The thing that, you know, is the closest, most important thing to my heart is my, you know, relationship with God, and it's been the symbol of its reality has been destroyed. And then you're taken, ripped out of your home and taken to this other country. And the theory that these countries had is they wanted to erase, when they would do this, when they would take a country and take them out of their land, they wanted to erase all cultural identity. Okay? They wanted to erase people, their religious rights. They wanted to erase their language. They wanted to erase their ethnic identity, their culture, their celebrations. So here they're, and then on top of that, they're getting tormented and mocked and belittled. And so there's real, genuine hatred there. How can we sing the Lord's song on foreign soil? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem as my greatest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it, down to its foundation. So the Edomites are people group that's watching Israel and Judah get destroyed, and they're also piling on the mocking. Daughter Babylon, doomed in destruction. Happy is the one who pays you back what you have done to us. Happy is he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks. So with these imprecatory psalms, what these are is these are psalms in which the psalmist, the songwriter, is calling down condemnation and judgment against their enemies. And in these are some of the most difficult verses in the Bible. And this would have been a psalm that, for me, 20 years ago, I would really wish wasn't in the Bible. Because I would say, oh, it doesn't fit with my understanding of the gospel and Jesus Christ. So I just wish it wasn't there. And so then when I come across it, I say, okay, well, what does it mean? So I go and I look up as many answers as I can that maybe excuse it away and say, oh, well, make an excuse for why it's in the Bible and try to kind of like defend it. And does anyone get where I'm coming from with this?